Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This podcast bonus was originally recorded during the GOX trip Land of the Thunder Dragon to Bhutan. To learn more about upcoming trips, please visit bobthurman.com.
Okay. So here we are, and these images are Guru Rinpoche, I think Padmasambhava. I think Rene mentioned specifically Padmasambhava, and who's known as the second Buddha, and what they call a great adept or Mahasiddha. And then we have the Pemalingpa, one of the great incarnations of one of the disciples of Padmasambhava, people believe. But he lived in the 16th century. And then he has an incarnation lineage very important in Bhutan. And then we have the Shabdrung, the founder of Bhutan, came here in the 17th century. And these are from the Nyingma order, and the Shabdrung is from the Kagyu order, of the four major orders of Tibetan Buddhism. And they're sort of approached to be indivisible from the Buddha. And of course, you know, all Buddhists know that these statues are not the people, but they're just a way of thinking and remembering them, that's all. Because, of course, in the Buddhist imagination, fully enlightened beings never leave the world, even though they may leave a particular embodiment behind. But the process of enlightenment, what it is a person who is enlightened comes to feel that they are everything in the universe, actually, all the other beings, in time as well as space. So they can't leave, kind of. It's not possible to leave when you already are everything. And they are in a condition of pure bliss connected with reality, they believe, and an inconceivable kind of idea, because they are not, you know, some people think that nirvana or some sort of absolute or ultimate condition must be something different from this relative world. And so that the people who attain nirvana sort of leave the world. And actually in Theravada Buddhism, they do think that. But in Mahayana Buddhism, non-dual Buddhism, enlightened being thinks they achieve this condition of pure bliss, but yet they do that enfolding the entire world. So that with all its differentiated beings and other things and space and time. So they feel they are released from suffering, and yet they encompass all of the world in which other beings are feeling they are suffering, unenlightened ones. And then that enlightened being has a weird experience, apparently. I mean, just to explain logically, I don't pretend to encompass that experience myself, unfortunately. But logically speaking, they have no need to be a specific thing within that everything, because they feel they are the bliss that is everything, but in all this specific detail, actually. But at the same time, they are aware that many of the beings, the unenlightened beings, who feel they are something separate from the universe, are suffering, and they're feeling discontented and frightened and painful and all this kind of thing. So they have a double awareness, an enlightened being, that they are, the whole thing is just bliss, and yet, and made of it, made of bliss in a way, that means, and yet there are beings in it who don't feel bliss, and so they feel compassion for those beings, and then therefore they manifest whatever it takes, the Buddhists believe, to by incarnating or by being present to those beings who are suffering, to try to help them feel become free of their suffering. And they have to do that because they know that by understanding the nature of everything, they realize that the beings who feel, who are shutting themselves off from feeling one with everything in a certain way, not by some conscious, any kind of negative idea, but just by because they think they are something separate. And they can't be sort of forced to open to their unity with the entire universe. They would then feel that as a kind of invasive energy, and so that would make them more shut off. So the only way that beings can find their reality and the freedom from suffering is by understanding it. And they can only understand their reality is by opening their mind to it. And that they only can do themselves. So the enlightened beings can only be there to try to guide them and to inspire them and to reason with them, etc., whatever it takes in specific cases. So this is just important to explain at the outset here in Bhutan, because we're going to see many temples, and there's that Western idea. Of course, I guess in its most radical form in Judaism and Islam, where you can't have an image of anything, like you couldn't have a kind of, in the inner sanctum in Jerusalem in ancient time and in any mosque, there can be no anthropomorphic image or image of any sort of living entity, because they feel that will be an idol, and then people will think that's God or that's ultimate reality, that thing. And so therefore, when we're in temples which are filled with images of beings, seeming idols, I mean, they are idols, then they're sort of a, we don't know what that means. We feel maybe the people there think that somehow the statue is going to save us or something like that. But Buddhists know that's not the case. The statue is just like a symbolic reminder of a being who is infinitely present, actually, they think. And yet, because a being like a being who feels that sense of separateness from everything else, like ourselves, like I feel I'm just myself inside my skin, so to speak, and everything outside my skin is not me, and it's a lot bigger than me and sort of overwhelming to me in a way. So anybody who feels like that sort of has to think that a Buddha or enlightened being is also some sort of separate entity that I can relate to or something like that. It's because it doesn't make sense to me to relate to sort of everything, including myself, as being something different than me. It can't make sense to my dualistic mind, you could say. So that's sort of to give us a sense of where we are. And then what we do in our study together, in these trips, first of all, we think of we are tourists, of course, but our visas say tourist visa. And I don't think they have a pilgrim visa, actually. There is no such thing. And the difference between a pilgrim and a tourist, I guess, is that a tourist is sort of just going around and looking what kind of weird things some other weird people do in a different weird country. It's sort of with a barrier between themselves and the thing that they're looking at. Whereas a pilgrim is also has a sense of barrier, but a pilgrim is going around visiting, the Tibetan word for pilgrim is a nekorwa, a person who is, or that's a Bhutanese word as well, a person who is going around to sacred places, who's traveling around to sacred places. And the idea there is that that person is seeking to learn something, to be touched by something higher than themselves. They're sort of open to becoming something more themselves in a way. It's not that they're just going around feeling, groveling around and feeling that they are nothing and some other great thing that they're seeing is something. But it's just that they are going to open to some influence or some presence or some understanding that might make them become something more than they are habitually. So, for example, the famous Japanese haiku poet Basho, who was one of the great pilgrims and lived in the 17th century in Japan, and the same century as the founding of Bhutan, actually. And his most famous work is called Journey to the Deep North. And he makes a pilgrimage circumambulating Japan and going to all the holy places. And he says that in doing that, when the pilgrim leaves their habitual home place, it's like they sort of their habitual self-identity, unchanging self, dies. And then they go out in a kind of open or between state, seeking to be reborn by encountering all kinds of higher influences in the places that they go to. And so then when they finish their pilgrimage, they are reborn as a higher being or something, an idea like that. So it's an idea of, and Deep North has a symbolic significance in his culture of death and rebirth. You know. So the Journey to the Deep, the Marvelous, collection of haiku and sort of travelogue, actually, is what it is, but it's a pilgrim's travelogue. So anyway, when we come to Bhutan and these journeys that we do, GOX organizes them for Tibet House, and Tibet House's mission is to understand, present, and preserve the Tibetan Buddhist culture. And Bhutanese culture is an element or an aspect of Tibetan Buddhist culture, although politically it's a different country. It's Bhutan, and they have a cultural nationalism and so forth, and they differentiate themselves from Tibet very strictly, which is wise, because if they were Tibet, they would be swallowed up by their big neighbor, which they don't want to do. And yet, culturally, it is like visiting. What's so marvelous about it for us is that it's like visiting a kind of semi-intact living piece of Tibetan culture, Tibetan civilization, and sort of present in the hearts of the people, in the minds of the people, in their architecture, in their cultural artifacts, in the way they've affected their landscape, in almost everything about them. And so that's why it's like a pilgrimage. They're organized like a pilgrimage, where we're going to touch something that will then open us to something new about us, ourselves, about our own understanding. That's the idea. And then there's the two levels of this pilgrimage that we do. There's the outer pilgrimage, what I call the outer pilgrimage, where we go to these different places and we visit temples like this, and we see landscapes and temples and from different eras, and we learn some of the history and so forth. And that's the outer pilgrimage. And then the inner pilgrimage is where we travel in our minds and we sort of go through the path that the Bhutanese Buddhist practitioner follows in their own learning and their own study and their own spiritual experience and their own life experience. And we sort of simulate that in our meditations, so that we get a feeling of the hearts of the people and what their culture, where their culture comes from. You know, their vision of reality, you could say, really, something like that. And it's good to say, perhaps immediately, that this does not mean, you know, when we were introducing ourselves, we encountered a Jew Boo and a Chris Boo and a sort of half Hin Boo, and that's good. And I want to repeat what Dalai Lama always says when he gives a teaching in any setting where people don't sort of denominationally think of myself, they don't have the identity label of I'm a Buddhist. And he says that's not necessary to be a Buddhist. And he says that, he says he likes being a Buddhist, he's used to that, whatever that means, and everyone has to study and learn to figure out what that means. But he says he feels that as far as the religious affiliation goes, it's best for people to remain sort of within the cultural fold of whatever they grew up with. He sometimes puts it, your grandmother's religion is what is good to remain connected to. And so what we learn from each other when we study other religious things that we think of as other religions, although there is an argument which we will discuss and I will present to you, where Buddhism in a way is not really a religion in the way we define religions in the Western sense, in the modern religious studies sense. In a way, it doesn't really fit that well in the category of religion. But still, it's considered a religion, and it is for some. And so he said, just switching denominationally, like I was this and now I'm that, is not really helpful to people. And it's what's better is to learn something about the mind and about how their mind works and to improve the quality of their mind, but to keep that learning within whatever cultural framework they grew up with. And so he always makes an appeal to people not to become a Buddhist and not to think of what they're learning from him as somehow an invitation to them to become a Buddhist. If I happen to be present when he gives that particular talk, which he does at the beginning of most of his talk, he glances at me or some other people like me, he says, well, some people just can't help themselves. Some Western people, he says. But he wants to be clear that he's not seeking that. And he thinks actually that, and he acknowledges that in Buddhist history, there, although Buddhists are not missionary in a violent way, they never had a crusade. They had wars and conflicts between each other, between Buddhists actually, and between Buddhists and non-Buddhists in history, and they probably will more in the future, but they're not over religion. They're not in order to convert them in some way, because they don't consider just sort of being nominally something to be that helpful to anybody. Because one can appropriate a nominal identity, a membership sort of feeling, by the ego, and it can simply increase one's selfishness and self-centeredness, rather than benefit one by opening one's altruism and connectedness, something like that. So that's also the thing. Nobody's trying to make anybody into a Bhutanese or to become a Buddhist or whatever. That's not what this inner pilgrimage is about. It's just to understand where they're coming from, you could say. So we can, in experiential terms as well as intellectual terms, is to develop that understanding. Okay, I think those are the sort of preliminary things, and now maybe we'll meditate together in a Bhutanese Buddhist manner. And the first step in such a meditation is what is called opening the field within which one is meditating. And in a way, it's auspicious to do the first meditation in a chapel like this, in a little mini temple, because in a way the field is right in front of us, meaning that, okay, so go into meditative mode, and you'll see what I mean as we do this guided meditation. So go into meditative mode. Now, one thing that Nina always insists I remind people of, and some of you mentioned Zen, so you may have done this kind of meditative practice. I'm sure you did if you did Zen. And in Zen, they have a thing for when you meditate, you sit with a certain posture, with your hands folded in your laps and your legs in half lotus or full lotus, and sitting upright, your tongue touching your palate, your mouth closed, breathing through your nostrils, chin a little bit tucked, shoulders a little back but not too stressed, etc., etc. And those are good things. That's a good posture for meditating, and ideally that's a good one. And then you're not supposed to move while you meditate. But this is not the case in our meditating, and so feel free to move if you feel uncomfortable, to change your position, whatever, get up and walk around if you have to, whatever, feel more free, so you don't feel in the length of what we do that you have to stay absolutely rigid and get terribly uncomfortable and so forth. Okay, so she always wants me to mention that so people don't feel confined when we meditate together in a guided meditation. One of you mentioned vipassana you had done, and vipassana practice, and vipassana is from the Burmese tradition, although all Buddhist traditions have the practice of what's called vipassana, and vipassana in Sanskrit or vipassana in Pali actually means critical seeing is what it literally means. So it means to see in an analytic and focused way, to develop an understanding of what you're looking at. And it actually is not the kind of one-pointed, thought-free meditation. That's called shamatha, standing sort of in peace or standing still. Vipassana is a discursive, critical, exploring type of, examining type of meditation. And although the way it's taught in the West at the preliminary level is what they call mindfulness, which just means sort of trying to be focused on whatever's happening in your mind at the moment, to be more and more aware of it. But in that way, it means that in that sense, though, one picks out these phenomena in the mind, and so that's the way the critical aspect comes in, the discursive aspect comes in. But we can talk about that more if you have tried that. So the first thing we can do is just draw some deep breaths, and then settle down and breathe kind of normally. And a very good thing to do, which is what all preliminary Buddhist meditations focus on, is where you just count your breath. Observe it at your nostrils, usually, where the air is coming in and going out as you breathe in and out. And when you observe yourself doing that and you observe the breathing, sometimes you have a tendency to breathe more quickly or more deeply, and you make a special effort and try to let the breath just flow normally. And then count it. And at each exhalation you count a number like 1, 2, 3, like that. And then your mind very soon, if you haven't done it much, or even if you have and you haven't been doing it for a while, when you try to do that, thoughts will arise in your mind that are not counting your breathing, and they'll wander away from the counting on some memory or anticipation or just random thought. And the idea then is to dismount from following that thought train and come back and just go back to the counting, and when you have been distracted for a second by a thought, you go back to 1. When you get to 10, after a while, without being distracted, you still go back to 1. And that's a basic thing. And that lets you notice actually how many random thoughts do come into your mind, and it's a useful, that's what they call mindfulness, and a useful, but it, which the word means literally remembering, actually. So you're remembering the now rather than remembering the past or anticipating the future. So we'll do that a little bit just to kind of quiet down. And if you can't get to 10 right away, don't worry about it. Just patiently recover from the distracting thought and come back to counting. And quite quickly you'll get a feeling of greater focus if you don't let yourself be frustrated that you are distracted. Just observe that and just come back to counting. Then, the next thing we do is turn your awareness around, and as if you were out of body for a minute and you were looking back into yourself, into your own face. sort of imagine as if you were looking into your face, and you were looking for your real face, like your identity face, let's say. You know yourself by your name. You think, you know, I'm, you know, Arthur. I'm Bob. I'm Renee. I'm Sume. I'm Brent. I'm Nena. And then you sort of imagine you were looking at yourself, and then you were looking inside yourself, in your brain, in your body, in your mind, and you're looking for the real Renee, or the real Bob, the real Nina, the real Mark, the real Adam. Where is the sort of fixed, unchanging thing that corresponds to the name? Like, where's the real Bob in here, in this complex that's me? And when I do that, even with a little burst of imaginary seeing, I immediately become a little uncertain, because I don't find inside some sort of real Bob. I can sort of think of my outer periphery from a certain perspective, like the way I might see a reflection of myself in a mirror. And of course, I'm fully aware that's not the whole me. And then when I go inside to look for what Bob really lands on, I don't immediately find anything. And I might, if I do it penetratingly, feel even a little uncomfortable at that. Like, where is the real sort of identity, the same unchanging essential thing that's me? And so just let go of it, is what we do here, because it's very preliminary. And just let the habitual self sense melt down, and with it, the sort of world around me that's familiar to me, that I think I know what it is, where I am, my GPS system. Google knows where I am, I guess, but even what is I that it knows, and sort of just let go of the whole thing. And then, from that sphere of pure potential, what the Buddhists call emptiness, emptiness slash relativity, the sort of inconceivable interconnectedness of everything. When within that I arise in my ideal setting, in the place I most want to be in the universe, feeling like the way I feel when I'm feeling the best I can feel, really joyful and poised and alert but calm, not sort of overexcited and not too zonked out, just very poised and alert and focused. And then imagine that above me is a kind of blue sky filled with bright sunlight, and maybe some fluffy clouds. And in the middle of that sky there's a giant tree. And in that tree there are jewel thrones. And on the thrones are the most amazing beings I can imagine. If I'm a Christian, I think of Jesus being there, maybe Mary, some archangel, something like that. If I'm Jewish, Moses, and also archangels, maybe Jesus the rabbi, Maimonides, you know, all the great thinkers in Jewish history. If I'm Muslim, Ibn Arabi, or some Sufis, or some Muhammad himself. And there are maybe some so brilliant light prophets, you know, so shining with light. If I'm a Buddhist, I think Buddha is there. And then think of all one's teachers in life, and they're all there, sitting on these jewel thrones in the sky. Or this Padmasambhava here, sitting like this statues, Shabdrung, Pema Lingpa, Shakyamuni Buddha, or any living teacher one might have ever had. And they're all there in their subtle Obi-Wan Kenobi bodies of pure light, like Obi-Wan appears in the Star Wars movies after he's passed away from his ordinary body. And they're all there and they're smiling at me, at you, because you're meditating, because you're in your meditative space, and your sort of shrine space, which is in your imagination, which is in a deeper reality. And although you're imagining it, in a way you're imagining that all these enlightened beings in history are still present, and these deities and angels and so forth, and that because they are everywhere actually. There is no limit to them. We're thinking of them as separate embodiments like ourselves, limited in space and time, but actually by definition, because they're enlightened, they are not limited in space and time. And they are everywhere. And so when we imagine them with us in a field which is our sort of refuge field, or our field of sanctuary, our field of sacred calm and peace and learning and openness and security, safety. This is the field within which the Tibetan Buddhist and Bhutanese Buddhist culture exists. And this kind of temple space that we're in, and with statues and tanka paintings on walls or murals or on tankas, they are just sort of aspects of this kind of field carried in the collective and individual imagination that they have, where they feel the Buddha is there with them, or this and that angel, and in all the different forms, Padmasambhava, you know, is there with them. And when they, or Avalokiteshvara, or Tara, the male and female bodhisattvas of compassion and miraculous saving activity. So in all our meditations, we will always set up in our mind such a field. And then in that field, we will then focus on a particular thing. Even if we do breath meditation, we first think of ourselves as being in the kind of supportive field like that, in a setting where we leave behind our habitual self-identity and we become open to change, actually. Open to new identities and open to new understandings. And we don't come in with the preconceived idea that I'm just me and I'll be me when I'm finished with this, and you know, there's no, I don't ever change, and all these kind of attitudes that we have, with which we limit ourselves unrealistically. Since we are highly influenced by everything around us, other beings, our environment, what we learn and experience and so forth. And everything changes us a little bit one way or another, all the time. So then again, if you're imagining such a field, being in your ultimate place, I always like to think of myself near Mount Kailash, with my facing south in front of Mount Kailash, with Lake Manasarovar sort of in front of me, and with the magical island in the middle with the tree growing from it. But you may have your own ideal place, south of Thailand, or Santa Barbara looking out from Montecito, or wherever it may be, Florida looking at the ocean. So it's whatever, wherever you feel most safe and secure and inspired. Always set that up. And then once you set it up, beginning your meditation with it, session with it, you can forget about it. And so you don't have to feel frustrated if you can't hold it in your mind steadily, because you haven't developed tremendous mental stability, meditative stability, necessarily. I mean, some of you may have, but most of us have not. And so then we imagine something, but then it wavers away from our inner vision. But don't worry about that, just sort of know that you are in this ideal space. And then we turn our mind to the very first step on the path, of the Bhutanese Buddhist path, and that is reflecting on how lucky we are. What an amazing creature I am. Each of you must reflect. How lucky you are. You're a human being. You're a free human being. You're nobody's slave. you're not demented, you're not, you know, sick, you're not, you know, helpless, you're not under threat of death, you're not starving to death, etc. And you are intelligent, you're not stupid, you're intelligent, and especially you can be critical about what you hear, what you learn, what you think. You can be critical about your own opinions and things. So you're capable of learning and educating yourself and changing yourself. And this is rare in the world, actually. You're not like a wage slave somewhere just sitting there making a widget. Some like low-wage factory belonging to Foxconn in China or something. You're not any such thing. You're a free human being with human intelligence. And not only that, but you there are great teachers and prophets in your cultural ken who have taught you something about there's some kind of a higher way of being, salvation or liberation or enlightenment, that you can develop yourself toward, that beings will help you with, although maybe all of them might agree, interpret it a certain way, that it's something you have to open yourself to. Actually, even omnipotent deity can't automatically save you, according to better interpretations of these theistic teachings. And in the Buddhist teaching, of course, even Buddha can't produce enlightenment in your mind. It can only give teachings that you have to learn and you have to understand. And so you just, but you, what you do is, to, in this meditation, is it's called the meditation on the precious human embodiment endowed with liberty and opportunity, which I have acquired through a tremendous evolutionary effort. And here the Buddhist theory of evolution differs a little bit from the materialist one, the neo-Darwinian one, in that it's not just a tremendous long billion-year experience of the genes, although it is that too, to develop the human form, but it is also your personal experience. Your spiritual gene has gone from body to body, from species to species, from a beginningless evolutionary presence in life, many lives, and you yourself, therefore, have made the efforts of intelligence and generosity and morality and tolerance and creativity and concentration and wisdom and realistic knowledge of the nature of reality, where you have chosen to adopt the human form. You know, you have got yourself conceived in a human womb, you're brought up by human parents, member learning and developing membership in a human culture on a planet where there is a teaching of freedom and liberation and enlightenment and so forth. Extremely rare amongst all the forms of life, even in this planet, much less in the vastness of the infinite universe, in infinite space and time. So that's the beginning of the path, is developing a higher appreciation for yourself, actually, for your body-mind present state. And at first we think, well, we don't have to meditate on that, we all think we're great. We're like, you know, modern people and so forth. But actually, from Buddhist point of view, depending on our sort of scientific notion of what we are as a, as an embodiment, as a being, it isn't for sure that people have this sense of appreciation of themselves. Because why, how, and how do we know that we don't have that? Well, we waste a lot of our lifetime. We sort of pass the time. We wait for some other time to do something significant. We feel bored and so forth. We feel, you know, we wouldn't feel like that if we realized how precious every minute of the time of our precious human embodiment endowed with this intelligence and this opportunity to become a higher type of being, even higher than we already are, which is very, very high. Within all the modes, all the possible life forms that we have been and we could be again. So that's the first theme that we will focus on later more tomorrow. And we do that within this field, and when we do, all the enlightened beings, the angels, the gods, the prophets, the whoever it is that we feel, the teachers, whoever we feel are the most amazing beings in the world, in the universe, in history, they're delighted that we're having this kind of a session, thinking this way, trying to develop a higher appreciation of our existence with a view to making this amazing existence that we have meaningful and utilizing it to the best advantage, evolutionary advantage of ourselves as well as others. They're delighted about it, and they're so delighted that they are not even content to sit in the sky and rain energy and light upon us. They themselves just melt into pure light and they flow down and they become one with us. So that all the beings we most admire in the universe, the gods, the saintly beings, etc., they become the one with us. They simply merge with us, which reflects that they do feel one with us, actually. And then we think of all the beings around us in the universe who don't have such beings to look up to and who are not aware of themselves having an opportunity of finding freedom from suffering. They think they just have to be resigned to their suffering. And they just slog along hoping it will just end somehow. But not really thinking that it's possible to be truly an incarnation of bliss forever, which is what enlightenment means. And so we feel, we bless them with whatever we've learned in this meditation. And we melt into light along with the beings, and we let our meditative ideal self melt into light and merge with all the beings that we know, good or bad, or familiar or unfamiliar, all around us in the vast field of life. And when we do that, we let ourselves again disappear like we did a little bit at the beginning, where we let our habitual identity melt. And so we again let our meditative identity disappear. And we go through a kind of melting closure of the meditative space. And then ding, the bell rings and we cease meditating. And we're back here sitting in. Because we don't want to go on too long today. And we're sitting here. So then we could do some questions if anybody has any, or we could take a break till dinner. But it's all optional. You know, I think maybe we should break. Probably we'll do more dialogue question tomorrow, unless somebody has a burning question about a particular thing that we were discussing, or you were meditating on, or something that came up for you in meditating. Yes, Adam.
Why do you personify the division? Why identify it? I don't know what the right word is. Anthropomorphize it?
Why
imagine whatever the image that you want to identify with as ideal? Why does it have to take
off? About yourself, you mean?
Yeah, as at the beginning of the meditation.
You mean these beings in the sky, the refuge beings?
Yeah.
Well,
why does that?
Because, you know, like, it's just a way of getting yourself into a special mood where you, create a setting, you know. In other words, in meditating, you're trying to learn something, actually. Or you're trying to cultivate something in yourself when you meditate. Even if somebody labels the meditating, you just want to blank your mind, you know, which some people do too. That is a type of meditating. Actually, not a very important type, actually, although in the West, many people think that's the great thing. But it isn't. It's a useful thing. It's an important skill to develop to be able to do that. But it's actually not the most important type of meditating. It's a subsidiary type. But even when you do that, then you're trying to develop a way of being where you're not thinking anything. So you have a kind of, it's like a tranquilizing type of meditating. It's called shamatha, which means staying in tranquility. And it's not recommended as a main basic practice in the traditional systems because it can become like a palliative, you know, like a Prozac or something. It can dull, actually, your critical mind that enables you to learn. And then it becomes like, and then life feels very jangly when you're not doing it. And then you want to rush back and do that. And like empty your mind and then feel like, oh, I can calm down. Like any tranquilizer. On the other hand, if you're over agitated, of course, it's helpful to be able to do that. And then eventually, when you get into really deep things like what's called the meditation on emptiness or selflessness, this type of thing, that ability to not have any thought that you don't choose to have in your mind gives you much greater concentration on penetrative thought in your mind, where you're critically, in Zen it would be generating the great doubt by thinking about a koan, or in Rinzai Zen, or in Soto Zen, the great koan is that you're sitting there and you're supposed to be Buddha, but you sure as hell don't feel like Buddha. And that's a kind of tension that your mind goes into in a critical way, actually, which is the real Zen is not just empty-mindedness at all, although it may be thought to be by some people. So the reason for... There's no need to, if you feel safest when you feel you're in a blank space and that you feel most inspired in that case, then that's how you would feel the presence of enlightenment. But most people, when they, you know, like they say historically, when people met Jesus or Buddha or Maimonides or any of the greatest or any of the great beings in history, saintly, amazing beings, or had visions of the burning bush or God or whatever people did, they got really keyed up. Wow, you know. And they were very impressed by that, and they were sort of rose up in a certain way where their mind was open to something, you know. I mean, a Tibetan Buddhist, if some bush started burning and started telling them to go see Pharaoh or something, Tibetan Buddhists would say, like, you go see Pharaoh. Why are you sending me? You know, like, you can burn bushes. Like, get over there in Egypt and burn some bushes downtown Pharaoh land, you know. Don't send me. I don't know what to do with that thing. Well, actually, Moses did ask that a little bit. He was a little bit, but, you know, the bushes overwhelmed him. The burning bush there, you know. The way they tell the story, anyway. I always think about Jesse Jackson saying, better to stay out of the bushes. And I think of that, so I know why. It's a terrible connection, I know. The connection to the Bible and the Democratic Convention. So that's why, you know, it's, you don't have to do a particular thing. Whichever thing, like it might be one's teacher one had in high school who was really inspiring to one, or it could be a parent, or it could be I always have Walter Cronkite up there, because to me he's kind of a voice of reality, you know, like, but that's my age, you know. CBS News used to be really something, and so it's whatever, if they were here you'd feel very on point, you know what I mean, because the whole point is for meditating is to create a setting where you're kind of inspired, open, focused, you know, you're not going to fall asleep, or you're not going to, you know, and you don't drag into your meditative session the preconceived idea that I'm always me, and, you know, I am what I am type of thing, which is very self-limiting, you know. And they say if you don't question that right away, then the ability to develop some sort of new aspect of your being through a meditative practice is already forestalled. So that's the reason for it. Okay? But it isn't like we have to do Buddha, or we have to do Padmasambhava, or we have to do this or that. It's whatever it is that turns the person on. You know? And of course, we're here in a place where the, you know, Padmasambhava and the Shabdrung is a big thing for them, you know, and Milarepa. So they have that all over the walls and everywhere, you know. Life of Buddha, as we'll see. You know? They have Buddha, because for them, see, Shakyamuni, you know, Siddhartha, he was like this prince, you know, like sort of the original yuppie, you know, and he was like, never had any unpleasant experiences, supposedly. Then he left it all, went out, and he went the opposite. He got all macho, zenned out for 6 years, didn't eat any food. And then he rejected that too as an opposite extreme, and then he understood the nature of the world. It's what he did, they say. He actually met God on the way, the local God, what the people thought was the creator, and found out God said, oh, I didn't really create it, I don't know how it works, you find out, please, and let me know later. I'm just God. I don't really know what's going on in my city, you know. There's a thing like that in the Buddhist scripture, where he meets God and God says, I don't know. And so therefore that's an example of a human being, you know, developing this deeper awareness of what's real, which is how enlightenment is defined, you know. So that's therefore very inspiring. If he could do it, that yuppie prince, I can do it, type of thing. So that's why they have his presence very much here. And Padmasambhava is seen to be a kind of almost angelic figure. He's human too, you know, this main guy here and sitting over there. And he's like, he's supposedly born shortly after Shakyamuni Buddha passed away, so about 2400 years ago. And he's still alive. He's somewhere over in Madagascar or something, you know. And in the copper-colored palace, which we'll see paintings of. And he was in Tibet at a certain point, and he came to Bhutan, and he was like a St. Patrick in Bhutan. You know, he changed the culture of the people here. But he's still alive. They think of him as a kind of immortal, you know, rather than, it's a little less than human, Padmasambhava. A little more than human, let's say. Superman or something, Padmasambhava. They think of. So that's why they make a big thing out of him. Shabdrung is a historical figure who was a Tibetan who came down here and got the Bhutanese people organized in the 17th century. Sort of like created a sort of Dalai Lama polity in a smaller scale in Bhutan that lasted, is still here, you know, somehow, luckily.
And Pemaling.
Any other question?
You should mention Pemaling.
What?
Mention Pemalingpa too about the...
Oh, Pemalingpa? Yeah, well, Pemalingpa was, he lived in the 1500s, 16th century, and he was a blacksmith. And he just, you know, he had illuminating experiences when he was young, and people began to realize he was extraordinary, and then eventually he remembered his previous lives, and people found different prophecies, and he was part of a tradition of what they call treasure finders, where they suddenly reach into a rock or something, and they pull out a text that nobody had heard of, and then this is a new teaching that seems to work efficaciously for people. So he becomes respected as a teacher, and then he develops the power of continuously reincarnating, which is a unique thing in Buddhism that the Tibetan Buddhists did, which is very interesting because other countries where Buddhism existed, where they believe in rebirth, that everybody gets reborn, in other words, but they never had an institutionalized thing that certain great teachers or enlightened masters would consciously choose to be reborn in such a way as to come back to their former students and continue to teach them in another life, again and again, you know. That's uniquely developed in the Tibetan culture for various reasons, and was very instrumental, I think, in the Tibetan culture in developing a kind of leadership thing. And for a monastic, very highly monastic society where people didn't have children. And so then a kind of... your leader reincarnates rather than the sun takes over, you know. So very interesting innovation, actually, quite interesting. They were in Burma, like in Burma and Thailand, they had kings who, then later people said, oh, that guy is the reincarnation of a previous king or something, or a monk. But it never was institutionalized. You know, sometimes people would remember that. So that was Pemalingpa. And then the Shabdrung came here, I mentioned, in the 17th century. Founded the country. There's some more guys around. Avalokiteshvara is usually there. Shakyamuni Buddha, that looks like Shakyamuni over there. Mm-hmm. Although Padmasambhava has a form that looks like Shakyamuni, so you can't always tell.
Were there ever any deities that were female?
I'm sorry?
Buddhas that were female?
Yeah.
What?
Female Buddhas.
Yeah, sure. Plenty of them, actually. Luckily, because the males are usually a little behind schedule. the most important one is that it's sort of most widely known as Tara, and there are famous 21 forms of Tara, and of course there are millions of them, the type of idea, you know, that she's like, there are a lot of myths and legends that we'll talk about, and we'll see depictions of her. And then there's the Vajrayogini, there's all these forms. But of course, we have to acknowledge that in Buddhist history, that India was a big patriarchal society at the time Buddha went there, and Tibetan society, all militarized societies tend to be patriarchal, and the women are pushed down and the men are machoing around and beating everybody up and beating each other up. And Buddhism does not condone that in a way, but in a way it gets infected by it culturally to some extent. And so, you know, like in history, for example, in the Tantric tradition where they have the most overt theories about female enlightenment, they most of the books are still written by men, you know, in the Tantras, you know, and the females are always there teaching them, but somehow they never write the books. So, you know, there's a famous set of 84 Mahasiddhas, or great adepts, and only 4 of them are female. 80 of them are male. And so it's a reflection of the, even though the theory is that there are even more females than males, and often all of the male adepts have female teachers, but somehow they're just recorded as being like that, but they don't write their own book as much. There are some books by female adepts, you know, even in Tantras. And in the monastic thing, there's the famous story about the Buddha's ex-wife and his foster mother came to found the female order of monastics, the Bhikshuni order, and Buddha said no twice to them. They were like sitting out there in the dust saying, we want to be ordained, and he said, no, we don't want to have a female sangha, female monastics. And he said, why can't we attain enlightenment? Yeah, you guys can attain enlightenment easier even, he says, just as well as any man. Well, why not? He says, well, because society won't tolerate it, he says. And it will shorten, therefore, the life of the community. And you guys are not the problem, you know, in a way. The monastic thing is getting the militaristic, violent people in there to, like, really fight themselves, in a way. That's actually what it is. You know, Buddha was a West Pointer, you know. He was a prince, which meant a warrior class, you know, in India. And so it's the whole idea of the monastic thing is to demilitarize societies, which it did. And Tibet and Mongolia are the ultimate example. India, Tibet, and Mongolia are the ultimate examples. It was sort of back and forth in the other so-called Buddhist countries. And for some period they would demilitarize, then they would remilitarize, and they'd squash down the monastic orders. So there's a thing, you know, and it's some of the modern feminist scholars are there, you know, they're saying tat tat to Buddha, you know, by saying no twice to the, but he was just being sociologically perceptive, because in fact, the Indian patriarchal culture was not tolerant of it, because why? The women are the slaves of the patriarchs, right? They bear the children, they do all the agricultural work, they bring up the children, they take care of the men, and suddenly they're saying, oh, I think I want to attain enlightenment, bye. I'm not going to be married in child marriage, you know, to enhance the family. I'm not going to take care of everybody. I'm not going to produce the progeny. I'm not going to cook, wash, plant, etc. So while you guys sit around in the coffee shop after a little bit of plowing and you're tired. You know, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to go be a nun, attain enlightenment, become educated, and you're going to have to feed me. You're going to have to bring food to me because I'll be a holy person. So, you know, when the Buddha did open the door to female monastics, it was like a stampede to get out of the Indian family system, you know? So it really was, you know, it was really a sociological statement that he was making. Nowadays in the West, the more enlightened teachers, they say, they have to acknowledge that the majority of the yoginis, the majority of the students are women, making the biggest effort. And they expect sort of modern Buddhist tradition to be strongly carried by women. And I think it is, actually, to a great degree.
I'm Gary Gawk, and this segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House U.S., Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal. Tashi Delos.